Hello, I'm Kirsty Young, and this is a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten the music. The programme was originally broadcast in 1997, and the presenter was Sue Lawley.
My castaway this week is a pianist. Her parents were Seventh-day Adventists and educated her at home until she was 11, laying the foundations of breadth of interest and originality of approach, which are the essence of her work. At both Cambridge and the Royal Academy, she refused to be pushed down too narrow a path, emerging as a champion of contemporary composers such as Birtwistle, Messiaen and Berlioz. She sees fewer divisions between jazz, classical and pop music than most, and her innovative concerts, in which she appears dressed less conventionally than most concert pianists, are designed to draw new audiences for music as a whole. You can present something difficult if it's exciting, if you do it with energy, she says. She is Joanna McGregor. And you achieve that, not least, Joanna, by talking to your audience. You're a concert pianist who speaks.
Yes, unfortunately, but I first discovered this when I was playing Bartok years ago, and I arrived at a venue and there was no programme notes. And I thought, well, this is terrible. I can't go out and play some very loud, obscure piece of Bartok, which it was. And that's the first time I ever spoke in public. And I realised that you do get then a tremendous feedback from the audience if you can just show that you're human and you've got a sense of humour. And you just give the slightest inkling of about, you know, what's about to happen.
I suppose traditionalists would say that good music speaks for itself and you shouldn't come between it and its audience.
I think good music does absolutely speak for itself. And I also think new music is often rather intimidating. And I think it's sort of the role of a performer to do everything in their power to just take all that preconception away.
Of course, new music, modern serious music, often has titles these days as well, which, of course, it never did. We all know the classical pieces by numbers and so on. I'm thinking of Django Bates' Piano Concerto, which you premiered last year, I think. It's called What It's Like to Be Alive.
Yeah.
You know, this is blurring the distinction, the edges, isn't it, between popular music and serious music?
Oh, it certainly is. But even that piece, I remember saying to the audience beforehand that the way he composed it was by putting up a washing line in his music room. And every time he wrote a movement, he hung it on this washing line. I mean, that was the whole point of being alive, was that one day it was traffic noise, the next day it was his baby crying, the next day it was something else. So, I mean, even a title like that needs some explanation.
So perhaps they should make videos of serious music. I mean, you can see a video made of exactly the image you've just painted.
I think new technology is a very exciting development. And while I think there's always a place for a chamber music concert, say, at the Wigmore Hall, with all the traditional trappings that involves, there's also got to be some development on other fronts as well.
But your performance is more visual anyway, because, I mean, quite often, well, I don't know how often, but you certainly play on occasions with the whole of your forearm, don't you? Back or lean up and actually play a note from inside the piano.
Yes, I must say, I do this when the composer requires it. I don't suddenly in a Mozart cadenza suddenly stop bashing with my forearms. But, yeah, I mean, that's the key to new music in the 20th century is that it does require a lot more of the performer in many ways. I mean, physically it requires a lot. So you have to walk on stage with an enormous amount of energy and a willingness to do these rather crazy-looking things.
But isn't it all an admission that new music, contemporary music, is incredibly difficult and that somehow the audience has got to be encouraged to work at it?
I would have said that 20 or 30 years ago that was the case. There was the one type of new music that was generally played and it was very forbidding. And I think these days what now is called new music is vastly wider range. And, you know, it goes right from the gamut of Michael Nyman, Philip Glass on one end and Birtwistle the other, and in the middle a lot of jazz. And so I think from that point of view it's much less intimidating than it used to be.
But nevertheless a lot of new music composers can try and make people feel quite guilty because they want at the end of a heavy week to go along and have a familiar bit of Rachmaninoff wash over them, you know, and makes them feel better. Why not?
Oh, I mean, I stick it on music to make me feel better. I absolutely do. I play a blast of Bach in the morning or something to get me going. But I don't think composers write music in order to give people a hard time either.
Let's let some wash over us now. What's your first one for this desert island?
My first record is John Dowland, because my mum had a lovely recording of Peter Pears singing John Dowland, and I grew up with this, and I've picked one of these songs, but the instrumental version played by Fretwork.
Mm-hmm.
The Earl of Essex Galliard by John Dowland, played by Fretwork. So you sit at the centre of these performances, Joanna, pretty unconventional, as I said, often wearing trousers or cowboy boots and so on, certainly no velvet skirts and pin-tuck blouses. You are a marketing man's dream, really. How desperately have you had to fight them off? Do they want to drape you across pianos and things?
Yes, I have been asked to drape across pianos, and quite recently I was asked to drape myself across the bonnet of a cab, and it's very easy, you just say no. It's quite simple. And
but they'd never ask Ashkenazi to do that, Brendel, would they? I mean, does it irritate you?
It amuses me, and all you have to do is know that you're in control of the image in the end, and, you know, and then you can stop any absurdity.
What about attacks from the music-listening public? I mean, do people ever come up to you and accuse you of playing cacophonous rubbish?
Only my husband, who has to live with Birtwistle sometimes, morning after morning.
But it's not an easy path, is it? I mean, the sort of struggling down the uncharted route with these modern composers. And it seems to me that you do that with more enthusiasm than most. I think a lot of performers are quite wary about the aggro you might get down there.
Well, I don't really see it as aggro. It's not easy, but I find it immensely rewarding and terribly exciting to be involved in a premiere. And that moment, you know, when the music arrives by post or whatever it is and you open it and you look through it for the first time. What's very hard is, of course, there is no history to a piece when you're playing it for the first time. And I think you forget that if you pick up a Beethoven sonata or a concerto, there is actually a history to the performance, which you've imbibed quite unconsciously. Of course, with a very brand new piece, there's none of that. And you have to make the first performance, literally.
Enormous responsibility, because also the composer's going to be there.
Well, the composer's going to be there, and you need to do it well, because the whole point is to do it well enough that it gets done again.
And it's probably the first time he's heard it.
Yes, very often it is.
Well, I mean, in all its full glory,
yes,
as it were.
Yes.
Is it true that Harry Birtwistle faxes you as you go from his house in France?
He has been known, yes. I remember when I did his concerto, I mean, he'd made a few alterations. And, of course, needless to say, he put more notes in. He didn't take any notes out. And he was faxing stuff over from France, you know, which was quite funny.
But the question that arises from that is, how do you remember it? I mean, new music, you know, as I say, can be very cacophonous, can be an enormous jumble of notes. Mm. How do we know you're playing the right ones?
Yeah, so many people have said that to me. Well, you could just be playing any old thing, couldn't you? And firstly, I've said, well, trust me, I'm trying not to play any old thing. I'm trying to play exactly what the composer's written. And, you know, don't forget that I have to spend hours and hours and hours a day on just maybe one bar even, you know, it's very hard. And there's a rhythmic structure underlying everything. And when you hear a piece for the first time, you are a bit lost. You go, my goodness, what on earth was that all about? But me as a performer, I know my way through it. You know, I've navigated this terrain.
Record number two.
My record number two is the wonderful Clive Rowe. I did a show with my theatre director husband of The Mystery Plays last summer. Huge, epic production. And the music all the way through was a cappella gospel. And I've taken with me Clive Rowe singing Lord, I've Tried.
I have lost connection. Oh, Lord, I've tried. Oh, Lord, sometimes I'm up, sometimes I'm down, and then I'm level to the ground, and then I'm climbing round by round. Oh, Lord, you know I've tried.
Clive Rowe singing Lord, I've Tried, and that was arranged by my castaway, Joanna McGregor. So you grew up with a lot of that sort of gospel singing, a cappella choirs,
yes,
unaccompanied choirs. By your Seventh-day Adventist parents, you were brought up. What does that mean exactly? What sort of upbringing was it?
It was a very, on one hand, rather eccentric, but also very loving and colourful and fun upbringing. We went to church every Saturday, which is where I heard all this music sort of all day. It was a black church and wonderful gospel music, and I had this sort of classic thing of playing the piano at church and playing all the hymns and everything.
This was in Willesden in North London.
Yeah.
And they believe in abstinence from tea and coffee. And
yes. Yes, I have to say they've really sort of rather mild now compared. But, I mean, when I was very young, they had me very young, and they were very enthusiastic, and so it was no tea, no coffee, no alcohol, no smoking. Very healthy lifestyle.
Was it a very strict upbringing, or was it quite liberal?
It was both. I mean, I think it was strict in the sense that they did have kind of religious outlook. And I was brought up to know my Bible inside out. But also liberal in the sense I wasn't at school and we worked in the morning and if the weather was nice, I played out in the garden in the afternoon.
How did that work? How were you educated at home?
Well, they used to buy all books, school books of maths and English history, and say, right, OK, this morning you're going to do 2 hours of maths. Now, you know, that's quite interesting. Say to 6 or 7 year old, you're doing 2 hours of maths. Here's the book. Now, start at this chapter. Here's the answers. Mark yourself. If you have a problem, come to me and ask.
Is this your mother or your father?
Both. Both. And So I learned from a very early age to work very hard and to enjoy working on my own. And, of course, this is what you do as a pianist. You just work on your own a lot of the time. But then I went to school at 11.
But what did the kids think of you when you got there? You must have been a slightly strange fish.
I wonder if I was. You'd have to ask the kids. I took to it like a duck to water. I couldn't believe that a teacher was standing up in class and telling us what to write, telling us what to put down. It seemed to me so easy that a teacher would tell you what to think. After that.
And how did you compare academically?
I think it was okay. I think, you know, when you're on your own, you make quite fast progress. And I probably had a few gaps in my education. But then, on the other hand, I had a lot of music. So
piano?
Piano, yes. There was a piano in the house, upright piano. My mum taught me to play when I was very little, and records, you know.
What did you play? Do you remember?
When I was tiny? Well, I played everything. I played, you know, I loved Mozart when I was a little girl. I think all children love Mozart because there are pictures of him when he was a little boy and there's a sort of great childhood recognition. I played a lot of Bach when I was a little girl and I played a lot of pop music. In fact, my mother told me recently, I'd completely forgotten this, I played so much pop music and jazz when I was about 10. Apparently she ran around the house sort of gathering up all the music and banning it, saying, listen, you've got to start playing classical music again.
And you got your grade 8 when you were 12.
Yeah, well, that's why she said, you know, until you take grade 8, you can't play any more pop music. So obviously I got to move on then.
Record number 3.
Oh, well, it's the Beatles. And I didn't quite know which pop group or piece of pop music to take. And I listen to pop music all the time, but I've taken a classic, which is Tomorrow Never Knows. To me, it's got the same orchestral texture as, you know, a symphony.
Tomorrow Never Knows by the Beatles from their album Revolver. I said at the beginning, Joanna, that you refused to be pushed down too narrow a path. People were very suspicious of this breadth of approach, weren't they, that you brought?
I think particularly once I went to the Academy, I was genuinely surprised that at that time, when you arrived with a music degree, they thought you left it too late to be a pianist.
Because you went to Cambridge first and studied music.
Yeah, I studied composition with Hugh Wood, which was fantastic. He was marvellous. Very much after my own heart, you know, quite a maverick. And, you know, at the Academy, I was just amazed that, you know, they had a very narrow definition of what a pianist should be, which was basically you practice the piano from the age of 13 and did nothing else, which is crazy because you need to have a trained brain of some kind to be able to play. You need to be incredibly organised and look far into the future to work out your schedule, you know. I mean, it's not just a matter of falling off a log and somehow being born with this great talent. There's a lot of other stuff that goes into it.
So why did you go to Cambridge first? I mean, you didn't know, presumably, then that you wanted to be a performer.
Not at all, no. I mean, I always played the piano, but I hadn't taken it particularly seriously. I certainly didn't do a lot of practice. And while I played quite a lot, you know, I was always performing. It wasn't a career option at all. I actually wanted to be a composer. And then I got a bit overawed by that whole thing at Cambridge, you know.
You found it all a bit stuffy, didn't you?
Yeah, it was stuffy and
you were into the leopard skin by then, I understand.
Well, listen, I was a punk at Cambridge, I have to admit this. And, you know, again, the music faculty seemed quite narrow. You know, I couldn't really make it out why you wouldn't also be interested in pop music and jazz as well as classical music. I think these things have changed, you know, in the last 15 years.
So did you think when you then went on to the Royal Academy that this was going to be liberation, and then it turned out not to be?
No, I didn't. I went along because I just seriously wanted to practice the piano for 8 hours a day, and I needed to do lots of work on my technique, and I wanted to get a bedrock of repertoire. You know, I drank in everything that the Academy could offer me, but knowing at the same time that I was going to have to make my own way, which is it's a sort of painful business, because everybody wants to do the right thing. You know, you want to please people, you want approval and recognition and all those kinds of things. But frankly, if you're into playing Charles Ives, it doesn't come like that.
But it takes great strength of character, I would have thought, you know, you alone in your post-punk period by now, but standing alone against the establishment, which says, look, if you want to succeed and be a concert pianist, this is what you've got to do. And you were refusing to do that.
Well, I think you just have to sort of know what your qualities are that you're offering, because it's very sad to try and fit in when you don't have those right attributes, you know. And I don't know, somehow I knew what my qualities were, and they were not, going to be someone who walked on in a long dress and did a nice, uneventful performance of Rack 2, you know.
What were they then?
Well, terrific interest in new music, an ability to put together interesting programmes and have a sort of more dynamic approach, you know, and an interest in trying to put together repertoire from different periods. You know, the things I'm still trying to do now, trying to work out how to do it.
Record number 4.
Well, it's the man I would have most liked to have taken to dinner, Glenn Gould, who's not around anymore, but, Glenn Gould is baffling and frustrating and wonderful pianist. And it's his seminal recording of the Goldberg Variations, which I think he made when he was 22 and really sort of changed Bach playing forever.
Glenn Gould playing Bach's Goldberg Variation No. 25 in G minor, and one of your great heroes, Joanna, notoriously particular about the pianos he played on and the halls. Are you pernickety in that way?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I think Glenn Gould found the whole business of performing rough, you know, and pianists obviously have this problem that you never know what kind of beast you're going to be playing on until you get there. But I think even above and beyond that, the whole business of performing is very volatile and it's very unexpected, and you never quite know what's going to happen to you before you step on stage and who's in the audience, and all kinds of strain. I mean, I remember once I was on stage and a lamp caught fire while I was playing. I was in the middle of a Brahms intermezzo and the audience were all shouting, stop, stop, you know. And last year I was about to go on stage and play Beethoven 2 and my hand was bitten by a dog and I was taken to hospital, given tetanus injection, you know. I mean,
what was a dog doing backstage?
It belonged to the artistic director of this festival, so obviously a dog with very high standards. Maybe he didn't like the way I was playing. But
do you worry about your hands terribly?
No, not terribly. I don't take any special precautions. I mean, I actually ride a horse. People say, what on earth are you doing that? But I have a slightly fatalistic attitude. Don't do anything stupid, but I don't wrap myself in cotton wool
either. But you chop vegetables with sharp knives and
things
like that.
Oh, yes.
Let's come to what I feel, anyway, was one of the big turning points in your career. You were lent a particularly wonderful piano, I think, when you were about 23. Tell me about that.
Well, I'd met an American pianist called Stephen Bishop Kovacevic, and he'd given me a couple of lessons, and he said to me, what are you practising on? And at that point, you know, I had just a hired upright piano, which was pretty gruesome. And I remember at the Academy, there was a terrible lack of good instruments to get on. And the only time you could possibly get onto a halfway decent piano was on Sundays. You'd go in on Sunday and bribe the porter with a packet of fags and he'd unlock one of the decent Steinways, you know. And so for 3 hours, you got your hands on a good piano. Mm. And Stephen took one look at this piano I was practising on and said, well, it's ridiculous, you know, you're a very talented pianist, but you'll never learn to play really well unless you've got a good instrument. And he said, I've got a spare Steinway Model A, which was left to me by Andrei Tchaikovsky. It's now in Kyung Hwa Chung's house. And I think you should have it. You know, I'm going to lend it to you. And I was just, you know, I almost fainted with this offer. And he said, well, the only thing is you've got to ring her up and tell her this. She's a little bit ferocious. You know, you say that you're a good pianist and you want it. So, of course, that's what I did. And it was terrifying. But then this wonderful piano came into the place where I was living. And it was fantastic. It was incredible.
Made a big difference.
Yeah, huge. Huge.
And then you were taken up by YCAT, the Young Concert Artists Trust, who only take up, I think, very few and very gifted musicians. And really, that was it. You were on your way from that moment.
It was a great endorsement, you know, of what I was doing, because they audition people every year and they take on a very small number of people to then represent, really, as a commercial adult performer, you know. And, of course, I hadn't done the competition route and it was just tremendous to be sort of given this great chance. And then they had us out on the road and there I was playing, you know, every week.
More music.
Oh, well, we're up to Mozart's Don Giovanni. I love all Mozart operas, and I think Don Giovanni is my favourite. I remember going to see the Joseph Losey film over and over and over again, just as a way to get to learn this opera.
Part of the trio from Act 2, Scene 2 of Mozart's Don Giovanni, performed by Kiri Tikhanova, Ingvar Vixell and Vladimiro Ganzaroli, with the orchestra of the Royal Opera House, conducted by Sir Colin Davis. You only have stopped playing once, Joanna, in the 15 years of your professional career since the point we just arrived at, and that was for a few months 2 years ago when your newborn baby daughter Miranda died. Were you worried that you'd never play again when that happened?
No, I wasn't worried. I was surprised that I stopped playing in a way, because I always see playing as, you know, it's the way I express myself. And it was interesting that I just stopped. I had no desire to play at all. And obviously I was devastated. I'd been ill for a very long time as well. And I listened to music all the time. I always remember Heward saying to me when I was at Cambridge that at one point he was talking about a piece of Messiaen and he played a very beautiful tune. And he probably won't remember this, but he said that music could be a great healer. You know, when terrible things happen to you, that often music can help heal you. And that really struck me. And he said that to me when I was about 18 or 19, and it really struck a chord.
But it's interesting then in that moment that it couldn't and didn't for a good few months.
Yeah, yeah. I needed to do other things. You know, I needed to travel a bit and think and be on my own and listen to music rather than actually play it. And when I went back to playing, I made two very big recordings, and I chose the repertoire very carefully. I made a big recording of Messiaen's Farigard to L'Enfant Jésus, which is a big 2.5-hour cycle about the baby Jesus.
20 Little Peeps, I think it's been translated.
20 Little Peeps. And it's a lot of things, this music. It's violent, it's angry, it's poignant, it's beautiful, it's very moving, it's very spiritual music. And, of course, it was no accident that's the piece of music I turned to. And it has a very special significance for me. Now, that piece of music and the recording. And then after that I played a huge Bach piece, the Art of Fugue, which again is about taming the chaos in a way. It's about trying to make sense of things.
And do you think the whole experience changed the way that you play?
Possibly. I mean, I can't see how it didn't, because I think, I think every performer walks on stage with their history. And inevitably, how you are is how you play. You know, there's no doubt that you can't separate the two things.
And do people who know you well say that you're different now, that you play differently?
Funnily enough, I think some people have said to me they didn't know what had happened, and they said, your playing has changed. Your playing is really, you know, this, what's happened? You know, and I've told them, and they're very shocked and very upset, but, people have noticed something. It's probably a new depth, I hope, but I think also a strength, as a new strength, because an experience like that is... It's so terrible that in order to somehow survive it and take it with you, you know, not cover it up, but just take it with you, you learn to be strong, you know.
Record number 6.
It's, I think, the greatest opera written this century, in my mind, Alban Berg's Wozzeck, which is a painful piece of work. It's about, the terrible life of the soldier Wozzeck. And I've chosen the bit... the orchestral interlude after Wozzeck's death, which really sums up the whole emotional impact of the opera.
Part of Act 2, Scene 4 of Alban Berg's Wozzeck with the Vienna Philharmonic, conducted by Christoph von Dohnányi. You also performed, Joanna, accompanied by your own pre-recorded tracks, as it were, multi-tracking. How on earth do you do that in the concert hall?
Yeah, well, with some difficulty. I mean, this kind of thing goes on all the time in the pop world, and, of course, classical music, it's a bit more unusual. And I did... there's a Mexican composer called Conor Nancarry who wrote for player pianos extraordinarily dense jazzy music, and the only way you could possibly reproduce it on stage is by multi-tracking, which is lots of pre-recorded tracks played by me and then... with me playing live against
it. Does that mean you have earphones on as you sit at the...
Well, it would look terribly groovy if I did that, but I don't bother with that, no. I mean...
Well, then how do you synchronise?
Oh, well, you can hear it all coming out of speakers and everything.
But didn't it go wrong on one occasion?
Oh, yeah, well, yeah. The sound went wrong. Yes, and I spent most of my time playing these fugues and shouting at the sound man at the same time.
But the audience enjoyed it.
Oh, they loved it.
I mean, am I right in thinking that there is part of you... that quite likes imperfection, not of that kind, of course. Now, you don't want mistakes and you don't want things to go wrong, but in the sense of recording music, you know, what you're after is a kind of performance quality, a happening, which will have imperfections, is that right?
Well, I'm much influenced by the producer I work with called James Mallinson, who, like me, likes to work in very long takes. And once you've made that basic decision, then you have to live sometimes with the odd flaw. You go for the basic overall arch of a take. Because performing, after all, is about the moment. You know, I'm interested in spontaneity, basically. I mean, this is why I am very interested in working with jazz musicians. And spontaneity is not about stopping and starting and recording a bar at a time.
Hmm. It's also interesting, of course, that as far as jazz is concerned, the ambition of the artist is to do it differently every time.
That's right.
And yet, classically, you're supposed to do it
the same. It's very interesting, this huge divide. I mean, a jazz musician will walk on stage, and the good performance will be because he did it differently, because he had something new to say at that moment. I think this is very, really strange, this divide, you know, and I think it's because we are, as classical musicians, we have the notes in front of us and we have to obviously stick very, very closely.
But you're not suggesting that you should begin to improvise upon the piece?
No, not at all. I mean, I think, you know, there are moments, obviously, in terms of ornamentation in Bach, French suites, for example, which is an invitation to slightly improvise, and also cadenzas in Mozart concertos you could improvise slightly. You know, we've only lost the art of improvisation in the last 100 years in the classical world.
Record number 7.
The great John Lee Hooker, the small man with the huge voice.
Here's some improvisation.
Yeah, this is a holler. Send me the pillow that you dream on.
John Lee Hooker singing Send Me the Pillow That You Dream On. You did about 60 concerts last year, Joanna, around the world. Several composers write specifically for you. You do world premieres for them. You've just been appointed Gresham Professor of Music, Gresham College in the City of London. What does that entail?
I've been appointed a joint music professor with my Liverpudlian composer friend, Stephen Pratt, and we give 9 public lectures a year on the meaning of new music, basically. What is new music? Why is it there? You know, what does it mean? And it's a fantastic thing to be asked to do. And the most exciting thing was I was taken into the hall before I knew that we'd got the job. They took us into the hall, which is the original old hall. And the first ever professor was John Ball, the Elizabethan composer, and they've still got the first page of his lecture. And the professor said to me, oh, yeah, John Ball gave the first lecture here, and William Byrd was sitting in the front row. And I just thought, wow, how incredible.
So it's an incredibly busy, eventful life you lead. How are you going to cope on this desert island where there's none of it? I mean, it's just peopleless.
It's going to be great. It's going to be quiet and there's no fax and phones. This is the best thing about it. So there'll be no composers faxing through their latest amendments.
But where would you direct all this energy, all this dynamism, all this enthusiasm?
You know, I wonder what I'd do. I really love the outdoors and the sea and the night sky and all that kind of thing, and I think I'd do a bit of thinking. I think the trouble with being energetic is that it is all action, you know, and I you need a bit of reflection as well.
Last record.
Well, my last record is by, I suppose, the first composer that really introduced me to very modern music, and that's the American composer Charles Ives. My mum said to me when I was a very little girl, she described that Charles Ives was a composer, because, of course, he was an insurance man by day and a composer by night, and she said that people used to stop him in the street and beg him to stop writing this cacophonous music, and this really tickled me. I thought this was very funny. But I've chosen The Unanswered Question, which I think is a real piece of music to just lie back and look at the night sky to.
Part of The Unanswered Question by Charles Ives, performed by the New York Philharmonic, conducted by Leonard Bernstein. Now, if you could only take one of those records, Joanna, which one?
That would be the Charles Ives.
Why?
I think it says everything, really. It's simple, but very all-embracing.
And your book, as well as the Bible and Shakespeare?
It's a book that I read years ago and I want to reread, called The Sleepwalkers by Arthur Koestler. It's a really wonderful history of astronomy.
And your luxury?
Very hard. I have this vision of an island that would be full of rustles and squeaks and marvellous, you know, weird bird sounds. And if I could record those, say, on a sampler and bring them back, I could get a composer to write a piece that would include all those island sounds.
Joanna McGregor, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For more podcasts, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.